Today's program was brought to you by Vignaoli Selection. Since 1999, Vignaoli Selection has been discovering and selecting Italian and Austrian wines that better suit your palate. For more information, visit VignaoliAmerica.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
And we'd like to welcome everybody to our very first episode. We're going to introduce our guests in just a moment here, but before we jump in, we wanted to take a minute just to explain what we're hoping to do on The Front Burner. The idea is very simple. It's a national current event show for the pro cooking trade. If you cook, if you're a chef, a cook, a culinary student, a caterer, if you're someone who's just interested in that field and following it and like reading about it and hearing about it, this is what we hope will become a place for you to come hear about what's going on in the industry every week and hear people who are involved in the industry talk about and comment on it. We've been talking about doing this show for a long time, and just to give a sense of what this show is, and it's a little painful for us because we're kind of going through, we did two pilots that are probably never going to be heard by anybody but us and the people here at the network. And through the fall, there were all these great stories. You know, there was the Union Square Hospitality Group going to a no-tipping policy. There was the New York Times piece and a lot of other pieces about the cook shortage that's going on around the country. There was the review in the New York Times of Bruno Pizza and sort of the commentary about all the hype that surrounds the industry and the different sort of pressures and disappointments that creates.
Right. There was our good friend Harold Dieterle talking about closing down his establishments somewhat around the same time as Mark Vetri sold his businesses to Urban Outfitters.
Right. So these are all things that were we on the air when those things broke. We would have tried to get those people on, our people related to those stories on.
That letter that Michael's partner wrote about, the Valkos review.
Yes, we for sure would have talked about Amos Fakahani's letter to Pete Wells.
For sure.
And next time something like that happens, we'll get into that topic. We just want to make a special note because it is only about a week that since this happened, and we sort of agonized over whether or not to devote a segment to the sad news this week. But Gina De Palma, who was the pastry chef at Babbo, passed away last week, lost a long battle with cancer. I didn't know Gina, but I had a lot of admiration for her work, and we know between us a lot of people whose lives and careers she's touched. We just wanted to offer our condolences to people who might be listening, who knew her, who worked with her, who got something from her from afar the way a lot of us did. We didn't think it was really probably appropriate to a first episode and what's sort of a celebratory show here to have a segment on that today, but we did want to acknowledge her passing. Just very quickly, we did two pilots, like we said. That was sort of our friends and family, I guess we would call that, of
well
the show. It was really instructive. I'm pretty sure we don't have our voices down. We've been listening to a lot of other podcasts and trying to figure out what makes them tick. I can definitely say when we heard our first pilot, we always thought, hey, it'd be great to do a show. You know, it'll be just like when we go out to dinner and talk about the industry, and then we listened to it and we sounded lethargic, and it just seemed so low energy and lame.
Well, you're always your harshest critic as well, well, Andrew.
So we kind of worked on that. But, you know, it was interesting. We have our heroes. We listened to a lot of Marc Maron.
Good stuff there.
I've become a big fan of the film spotting guys from Chicago.
That's another great one. Yeah, I guess for me, I was listening to a lot of car talk, things like that.
Right.
Comedians in cars. I find that one a good one.
Yeah, and those are things that we kind of aspire to, right? We think that by having people in the industry talk about the business, people in the business will be interested, but also maybe people who just like to hear people talk about something they're passionate about.
Absolutely.
Will also be drawn to it.
So, well said.
Just very quickly, we have to acknowledge some people. Again, the pilots will probably never be heard, but people who gave us their time. Frank Crispo came in. Aaron Sanchez came in. Barry Wine of the late, great Quilted Giraffe gave us a great interview. Joey Campagnaro and Josh Eden came in. You'll never hear those episodes, but they helped us get to this point.
We're going to get those people back with us because yes. There were some real jewels in those episodes.
And we need to thank Aaron Fairbanks, the executive director of Heritage, and also executive producer Jack Inslee. Also, just very quickly, and you know, the whole idea of this show is that we're going to be going from week to week and trying to book guests the way they would book guests on Meet the Press or something like that. We just read yesterday about Kat Kinsman, a writer that we're very friendly with, who's doing a project called Chefs with Issues, dealing with mental health and substance abuse and other issues surrounding this industry. And it was just too late to get her in for today, but she's going to be in the studio next week. And we're really excited about that. And
that's going to be great.
And right before we came on the air, I got an email back from Jesse Schenker, who's been very open about his own history around this topic, wrote a book about it called All or Nothing, and he's going to come in as well. So we'll look forward to that and whatever else breaks next week. So all of that said, we'd like to welcome for this week's show, our guests in the studio, we have Amanda Cohen from Dirt Candy Restaurant here in New York City. We have Harold Moore of the late, great Commerce Restaurant, and also an upcoming restaurant, Harold's Meat and Three at the Tommy Hotel in New York, which will open sometime this spring. And by phone, Gavin, are you there?
I'm here.
We have Gavin Kazin of Spoon and Stable Restaurant in Minneapolis. Welcome all. Thank you very much for being here for our first episode. You know, the thing we wanted to talk about, and it kind of threads through some of the stories from the fall that we were just mentioning a second ago, is what we kind of call staying alive. It seems like if you talk to a lot of people in the industry right now, there's a lot of challenges for the contemporary chef. You know, without wanting to sound derogatory or critical about it, there is sort of a short attention span in the media, it seems like, and definitely on social media, almost by definition. There's a staffing challenge that's ongoing in the industry. I hope this doesn't seem an offensive way to put it, but it seems to me, you know, there's a cook shortage. There's a question of, is there a chef surplus or is there a restaurant surplus? Are there too many restaurants, you know? And the question is, how does a chef stay on top of this and stay relevant, keep people coming in, stay true to who they are and what they want to do and why they started doing this in the first place? You know, Amanda, as I'm saying this, you're nodding. Maybe do you want to – what's your first kind of response to this, you know, in a very just general way if I throw this out there?
Yeah, I think it's a learning process. There isn't an answer. Every day we're all trying to figure out how do we stay alive, how do we stay important enough for the media to report on us, and how do we get people to want to work for us too? So there's this whole balance that happens. And then sort of in all of that is, how do you make enough money just to stay alive? And it is so hard these days in New York. I don't know how restaurants actually make money. 7 years into this, I'm still trying to figure it out.
By that you mean, and you wrote about this in a column back in the summer, I guess, the money piece or the business piece. But, you know, this seems like kind of a unique – Jimmy and I were actually talking the other day. It's kind of a unique thing that's expected of chefs, right? You have to do the creative work. But then you also have to be a business person.
You have to wear so many hats these days. So let's say this is about my 20th year in this industry, and maybe a little bit longer, 25. And when I started out, to be a cook, you just kind of had to be a cook. And, you know, then one day you became a chef, and, yeah, you had to learn sort of the business side if you wanted to open your restaurant. But that was sort of it. And now you have to do so much. You have to know the business back and forth. You have to know social media, and that is a whole other job. And then I find that the industry, the people who are coming to work for me are much, much younger than they've ever been. So now I have to learn how to be a boss to like kids who are like 18 and 19 years old, which means that it's much more of a parental role. So there's these like three or four hats that you're wearing constantly.
Right. And the younger ones can have perhaps sometimes some false expectations of what's in store for them.
They're ambitious.
Which is a great thing, but also, you know, your career isn't built in a day.
No, it's not. So. And it's really hard to explain that to them. I'm always like, you know, just because they're like, well, when do I get to do this? When do I get to do this? I'm like, I don't know. Stop talking to me.
Yeah, I just say, when we're done building your foundation. And they look at me quizzically.
What's a foundation, Jeff?
Yes, indeed.
But what about this notion of just from a bottom line, you know, from a, you know, customers in the seats day to day with the amount of, again, the amount, you know, I have been saying to people recently that, you know, customers need to stop treating restaurants like movies, right? I feel like people have this list of restaurants they need to go to, and they go and they sort of check it off their list. Or if they really like it, maybe they'll see it a second time. But the amazing thing is, at least in New York, you know, it seems like there is this proliferation of new places coming in behind the old ones. There's like new places every week, it feels like. It's they're almost coming out the way movies come out, but you can't treat them that way or they're going
to
die.
You can't. Restaurants start to seem really disposable.
Yeah. So how do you guys as chefs deal with that?
Well, I'll answer for me and then I'll let everybody else answer. When we opened the second Dirt Candy, which was much bigger, and it had that hype problem. And hype really is a big, huge issue. Because you can't control it. I mean, you have a PR company, and obviously you want some of it. But at the same time, people's expectations are their expectations, and that's not something I can really control. And what we found is, and if I ever open another restaurant in New York, it's sort of like the first 6 months are this waiting period.
Right.
You just have to let all those people who want to come in at once come in. And then they go and you never see them again. And then the following 6 months and years after that, that's when you start to build up your regulars. Those are the people who come back. Because the people who really care and want to come back, they don't have to be there on the first month. And
right.
You do find those people who are there on the first month. They're like, I came, I ate, I had two things, and now I'm off to the next restaurant.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's some the press has a little bit to do with this in the sense that really what we read most about is what's new. And we don't read about what's beloved or what's classic or what's quality oriented,
right?
More so than what's new right now. You know, my core thought for longevity is my best dollar spent in house. So I want people who show up at my front door to be rewarded for it. And the reward is as simple as I want our people to show them we care.
Yeah.
You know, we want you to know that we value you as a guest and that we care for your patronage. And we want to show you that.
Right. Gavin, when you hear us talking about this sitting here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and having this conversation, what's it like? You were here in New York, you're in Minneapolis now. What's it like there? Is there a similar sort of proliferation there? Do you feel these kind of issues that we're talking about here? How's it feel relative to where you used to be?
You know, I mean, in Minneapolis, I feel it's very much the same way. You know, when I came here and left New York to open up the restaurant, there was a lot of hype and a lot of energy behind the opening, much of which we didn't have to necessarily create. It just sort of created itself, and then it snowballed. And what Amanda said is right. It's like the first 6 months, all these people come in and they check it off the list, and then you rarely see them ever again. And if you do, they've just popped into the bar to get a drink, to check up on things, and then they leave. So it's the same here, but it's a lot less because there's not as many restaurants. There was a restaurant locally called La Belle Vie, which is a very celebrated fine dining, sort of the pinnacle restaurant in Minneapolis that just recently closed after 18 years. And the chef gave a quote in the paper here, and he said, well, if everybody who's sad that we're closing would have just come in once a week, we wouldn't be closing.
Yeah, well,
and it was
said.
Kind of an interesting quote because, to your point, Jimmy, it was like, instead of always writing about the new restaurants, what about the old restaurants? And there's a local magazine here called Minnesota Monthly that just started doing reviews where the two critics are reviewing a new restaurant, and then in every monthly magazine, they're picking an old favorite.
Yeah.
And they're saying, okay, now let's go back to this restaurant that's been open for 15 or 20 years. And I thought that was a really creative way to sort of divert the hype and the energy of what's always new and just focus on what is actually delicious. And, you know, one of the things that I recognized very quickly and very early on when we opened Spoon and Stable was, no matter how we open the restaurant, we're going to face the hype. We're going to face the scrutiny. What's our core? What do we believe in? And what's the core value? And if we can stay true to that, we just have to keep moving forward.
Yeah, it's funny. The whole timing thing is so skewed. You know, it used to be you maybe wouldn't get reviewed for your first, you know, until you were open for six months, you know. And now it's
right.
The cycle takes like 6 weeks and everybody's kind of come in and had their, you know, said their piece about you. And, it is kind of a crazy sort of inversion of the way it used to be. We're going to take a quick break here. We're going to pick up as soon as we come back and bring Harold into this conversation. And we'll see you in 2 minutes on the Front Burner.
Selection, Dino Tantawi brings together some of Austria and Italy's finest cult wine producers. Dino makes frequent trips to Europe to bring sommeliers and consumers some of the best small vineyard wines. Every wine in the portfolio is selected for its unique attributes. Dino is especially known for his emphasis on the importing of terroir to fine wines and looks for vineyards with microclimate that perfectly express the terroir.
And welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We're here with our guests, Amanda Cohen and Harold Moore, and by telephone from Minneapolis, Gavin Kazin. Harold, I'd love to bring you in on this. Your restaurant, Commerce, closed in, was it July?
July.
In July. You briefly did a, I guess what we'd call a pop-up, more food and drink, and you have this new place coming. But you've also been looking to do other things. Can you just talk to me? I'd love to, from the vantage point of someone who's looking to put other projects together, first of all, how many meetings, phone calls with potential investors or partners have you had since July?
I think I've talked to everybody. You know, what I would say is relevant in New York and outside about, you know, what are you going to do next? How do you fit into their scheme and stuff like that? And, you know, I have a different vision for my career, so it's a little harder. We're going to try and go at it independently and have a larger group versus,
right,
like working for like a Steven Starr or, you know.
Right. But does this, what we're talking about right now, this idea of how do you have a restaurant that is built for the long haul, that's built to constantly generate press, that's built, you know, for this sort of climate where you seems to me like people who do what you all do for a living are, you know, I always think of, you know, when they say that people in Congress spend, you know, 50% of their time legislating and the other 50% making fundraising calls. I feel like that's what it's like for chefs these days. You spend so much time, you know, doing events and coming on a radio show and being on social media. And like, it just seems like you're constantly having to kind of, you know, wave your arm and be like, hey, we're here. Does this come up in the concepting of a new restaurant for you?
It doesn't really. I just, you know, I look at restaurants like Raoul's in New York. It's like 40 years old or 42 or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, I think that they just sort of stick to the knitting and are good at what they're good at and try to treat everybody nice and do that. And you sort of build a following without having to touch every hand or every table. I mean, it's great if you can attract new people via all these other outlets, but really it's you have the power when they walk through the door, and that changes everything. So like if you look at like the success of like Red Cat or something, it's you know, not every dish is like fireworks and stuff, but when you eat there you feel good, and then you think about that dish the next day or 2 days from now or the next time it's that time of year that you were there or whatever, because something resonates with you. The staff's really friendly, the food's really solid, you know, and there's a belief, whether it's real or not real, that you can get in. I think that's important. And we had that at Commerce where people believed that they could get in, and they could. They just kind of had to wait a little bit. But, you know, the idea was that this is every man's restaurant and there's something for you here.
Right, and having that built into your core.
That's what I try to concentrate on, because you can't control the press and you can't control the hype and what people think about you, other than from how it sort of emanates from inside, your spirit of hospitality.
I mean, I'd be curious to hear from Amanda and Gavin about this, because you're also talking about restaurants. Commerce opened when originally?
2008.
Okay, 08. Well, Red Cat opened in 99.
Yes.
So,
08,
but the new Dirt Candy, more recent.
2015.
Right. And Spoon and Stable, obviously, very late in 14. So I'm just curious, is that enough these days?
I don't think it is, honestly. I mean, but I, you know, if you all know me, I like to talk a lot. So I'll do anything for free, basically. It's really hard these days, especially in New York, where there are so many restaurants, to get your name out there, to get people in your door. When I opened in 2008, the original Dirt Candy, I was kind of the only fancy-ish vegetarian vegetable restaurant that opened, and I was the new thing, and so we got people in our doors because of that. But now there's a lot of other vegetable forward restaurants out there. So how do you get people into your restaurant? And the only way I know how to do that is to do a lot of press, to keep my name out there, to keep it in, to keep it important, to keep people wanting to hear more of what I have to say and more of what we're doing. I don't know how else people get like seats in. I have a 50-seat restaurant. I have to do 100 to 120 people every night to stay in business. It's the middle of winter. I will do any press to get people in there at this moment.
And you don't feel that same sort of repeat, and I'm not trying to be contradictory or contrarian about what Harold just said, but I do wonder if that old model of, like, you know, good restaurant, welcoming, well-run, if that's enough anymore. It seems like you feel like you need to constantly be sort of canvassing for yourself.
For me, I do. I mean, I hope we're a really welcoming, nice restaurant. We have tons of regulars. They come back. People often make their next reservation on their way out the door. But there's so much competition out there. And we're not the cheapest restaurant. You know, we're not the most expensive.
Right.
But we're not one of those sort of part of the proliferation of these fast casual restaurants where people go in and they can, you know, get in and out for under $75 or $30 a person, whatever it is. You know, we want people to come in and have a two and a half hour meal and spend at least $100, hopefully $150, hopefully even more. And I don't know how to stay relevant if I don't, you know, keep my name out there.
Yeah.
Right. You know, one thing that we didn't touch on in this relevancy or longevity thing is, you know, we're talking about the press and we're talking about being appreciative to our guests and our staff. We can't do anything without our staff. So a lot of, you know, our hospitality starts with the greatness of our own people. But the one thing is there's other ways to attract more guests, and that's in how you build your restaurant and your investment group. You know, what happens if your investors are four dentists from Paramus versus what happens if your investors are, let's just make up a number. Let's say it costs $500,000 to open a restaurant, and you take, you know, $125,000 from four separate people who are, you know, maybe like-minded and maybe know each other and have a similar job. Or maybe you do something that's a little more unorthodox and maybe a little scarier, and you take $10,000 off of 50 people. You know, conventional wisdom would say the less partners, the better. But the thing about the 50 people for less money is, if you insist that every single one of those 50 people have a different job, and they have obviously a different core group that they socialize with, on day one, what do you think is a more fun or full restaurant? The one that has, you know, that's financed by four dentists from Paramus, or the one that's got 50 people that have 50 different jobs and 50 different groups of friends and people they socialize with?
So the investor is ambassador.
Well, you know, there is no silver bullet. Like Amanda was saying it, Harold saying it, Gavin touched on it. You know, we have to fight for every dollar. We have to work every lever. Gone are the days of people coming to see you just to see you. You have to fight to stay relevant so they remember to come see you. So, you know, my point of view is it's a call to arms. If you like what you – if you've grown to like an establishment and the need is for you to support your local business, or it will go away.
Gavin, how's this all play with you?
No, I mean, I agree with a lot of that because, you know, having an outreach, I mean, one of the reasons that I decided to come back home to Minneapolis was because I wanted to be closer to my family, and I wanted my kids to grow up with my parents, and I had a lot of very selfish reasons to why I wanted to come back home. And it was the first time in my career that I could make those selfish decisions because often as a cook, when you're coming up in the industry, the right thing to do and often what you're told to do is to listen to your mentors and to go sort of where they tell you to go and follow this path and hope that at the end of the path there's a goal and there's sort of the bucket at the end of the rainbow. And so when I came back home here and we opened up the restaurant, you know, having to fight for people to come in wasn't necessarily the difficulty. The difficulty was trying to explain to people why I left New York. That's what they didn't understand, and so that actually was more difficult in coming across to all of them. So, you know, I think that what Jimmy touched on is I agree 110%, and it's one of the things that we have a large group of investors, and they're from all different industries, and they're from all over the country, and majority of them are from here. But as a result, we see a lot of our different investors. They've become our ambassadors, and they've gone out and they've you know, come and help make reservations for their friends that are coming into town or whatever it might be. And I think that that's helpful. You know, you need to get them behind you. I mean, it's a business, you know, and it is really, being a chef is very important. Being creative is very important. Doing delicious food is very important. But you have to make money. You have to make money. Yeah. That's the end of the day.
Yeah, it's it. I'm sorry, Harold. Did you want to?
No, the money part is the real the crux of it. You know, when I've got my first chef gig, it was 2000 at Montrachet, and it was easy to make money back then because you didn't pay people as much. Food cost a lot less back then, and
the regulations and the bureaucracy.
Yeah, the health department was like a dream back then. And so a lot of that money fell to the bottom line. And if you look at the price of entrees in 2000 in New York and the price of entrees now in New York, well, it's like maybe $3 or $4 more, but it's exponentially larger, the payroll.
Yeah, but the rent.
And the rent is crazy.
I signed my first lease in 99 for $35 a square foot. I re-signed it last year for $165 a square foot. Can I charge that much more for a chicken in Chelsea?
Wow.
No.
It's a lot of green beans.
Yeah, that's a lot of green beans. Well said. Thank you.
Gavin, I'm curious, you know, again, from where you sit right now, you know, it's funny. It used to be, if you wanted to be a, you know, big name chef in the United States, it was almost like wanting to be an actor, right? The advice was you wanted to come to New York. You wanted to go to L.A., maybe Chicago. You know, there are a couple of big cities where kind of all the action was, right?
Yep.
And now it feels like, you know, there's, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of this whole conversation, is there a chef surplus? And it seems to me, well, maybe in those traditionally huge markets there is, but that there's a lot of room in, you know, I don't know what a non-offensive way to put it, but, you know, you hear chefs talk about like second markets or, other cities that weren't traditionally thought of as food hubs, right?
Sure, yeah. Minneapolis is a B-market food city. I mean, there's no way around that, and that's okay. I think it also points back to the conversation about relevancy. I mean, would I have been as relevant in New York as I am in Minneapolis? I don't think so. I mean, here I can create a different point of view that people are willing to listen to, and a lot of people are willing to listen to it because it's very different than what is the norm around where I am. And it's not, you know, I didn't make the move because of that reason, but that just sort of happened and became what it is. I think that there's a lot of incredible chefs in those big cities, and to work in a city like New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles or Chicago, I think it's important for your career. I think you have to do it. I think you should do it. And if it's the right place for you and you want to live there, then stay there. If it's not and you want to move back home to Minneapolis or to Detroit or to Nashville because that's where you grew up, then you have the opportunity to do that now because there are investors in all of those cities that are willing to give you money because you're going to pay $10, $15 a square foot for a space that you can build out for a quarter of what it'll cost in that bigger city that you were just at. You know, now, granted, you can't charge as much. You know, you still have to face all of those same issues in a smaller city that you do in a bigger city. Those issues do not go away. But it's just on a different scale, you know, and I think that's the thing that I've learned more than anything is that the scale is just different. That's all.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the point also is that there's maybe, or what I was going to get at before was also, you know, as the sort of average level of sophistication has come up across the country, there are diners looking to support what a chef like you and your peers in Minneapolis or in Charleston or in, you know, all these cities around the country that are sort of, they seem almost like sponges, right? They can take so far. They haven't become oversaturated yet, right?
Right.
So right. There's this real sort of appreciation, eagerness, welcome, hospitality on the part of the customer for what is on offer from these chefs that are in markets where traditionally they didn't used to be. Is that accurate?
Yeah, 100%. And I think it also goes the same for the people that work in our restaurant. You know, I mean, the servers and the cooks and all of them, listen, they grew up here. So, and I remember when we had the first week of service, we had a really bad night, and I had a talk with all the cooks, and I said, I understand that none of you had the opportunity, because life didn't present it to you, to go to a city like New York or whatever and do 2 or 3 years in those cities, but this is the closest you'll get to it, so let's go. And it's, you know, to me, that was sort of an eye-opening experience, because it's like, just because we're in Minneapolis, does that change the way that I'm going to train the cook or change the way that I'm going to talk to a server and train the server? Not at all.
Right.
In fact, they're more sponges to it. They want to learn more.
Right. All right. Well, on that, we're going to take a break. And when the Front Burner returns, we're going to have this week's Shop Talk segment. And the topic this week is time away from the kitchen. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. The third and final portion of the show is devoted to our Shop Talk segment, where we kick around some aspect of the chef's life. Today we're going to talk about time away from the kitchen. And the sort of premise of this topic is that it seems like, you know, a lot of people who are drawn to the cooking life are drawn as much to the life as they are to cooking. There's this sort of, first of all, this initial sort of pinch of wanting to cook for people and the hospitality gene. There's this sort of adrenaline rush of the nightly service and the way a day sort of builds to that. And then whatever kind of post-service rituals one may have in their life is obviously, for a lot of people, a part of the life. And, you know, the question is, what happens when that's taken away? What's that time like? And all three of you here, for different reasons, have had time like that in the last few years. You know, Harold, since Commerce closed, you're in this sort of in-between period right now until the new place opens. Amanda, you had some time between the two Dirt Candy incarnations. Yeah. And then Gavin, of course, you left New York, relocated to Minneapolis, and had a pretty... actually pretty fast given what you guys did, but a build out phase and a development phase. So the question I just wanted to put out there, and maybe Harold will start with you if that's okay, is what are sort of the ups and downs of that? What's it like when you go from having this thing that's probably since you were in most cases a teenager, this daily rhythm and daily opportunity to cook, what are the sort of emotional hardships of that kind of time, not having that? And then what are maybe the benefits in terms of perspective and having some time away to sort of let new ideas germinate?
Well, I think that I first missed the food, the changing of the seasons is hard because with the change of the seasons comes a flood of new ideas, and not being able to express in that way was difficult. And also, not having a place to go. I think chefs are very routine-driven.
Yeah.
And so not having a place to go or a sense of purpose in that way. But, everybody on a certain level of chef spends some time out of work, so you're going to have to deal with it. But I think that we've been busier administratively since I left, or since Commerce closed or whatever.
Yeah.
More than ever. I used to have my days more or less free to fool around with you or whatever. And now it's
dirty.
You gotta go to a meeting, you have a conference call, this, that, chasing money or, fulfilling people's expectations. And it's just a different kind of life. I kind of can't wait to get back to work.
Yeah. Do you cook more? A lot of chefs don't cook home hard ever, Yeah.
No,
Do you cook more in this time that you've been away from a restaurant?
I've cooked a few things at home. I don't like working at home. I don't like the scale of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's been a big challenge, is cooking the appropriate amount of food for two people is not easy. And then shopping for it is a pain. In the city, shopping is you have so much great stuff, but it's a 3-hour activity to make a little bit of dinner, and then you bought $60 worth of chanterelles. It's come on. You have to really sort of be disciplined about it.
Yeah.
Right. Harold touches on the best point. When we set out to create, in a little bit more of a mass production mode than serving dinner for two, whether it's, maybe I think Amanda alluded to 150 people a night. You calibrate yourself. So when you take yourself out of your kitchen and you take yourself out of your routine and your rhythm, it's hard to have the passion for the calibration because anybody who's a good cook can be able to make a great dinner for two. But that's probably not going to be enough to make you a great chef, for many different reasons. So when you're doing these things at home, they're more of a labor of love, and it's harder to work out this idea that you have because you're not working on the same appliances, and you're not thinking about it, or you're trying to think about it, but it's not as applicable when you're saying, I'm going to make this dish up, and then I'm going to teach it to this cook or these cooks, and they're going to replicate it a couple hundred times a night. So when we think about a dish like that, we think about how are we going to execute this repetitive task of quality and of consistency, where at home we're we're going to make something good and we're going
to
eat it.
You also have to do the dishes at home. And nobody likes to do all those pots because at home you're I'll cook this whole thing and use 20 pots. And you're I'm not in the restaurant, right? One pot meal. That's where their cookbook's called, One Pot Meals.
Right. And then to Harold's point, how long does it really take you to eat, $60 worth of chanterelles? Right. Do you really want to have chanterelles 4 times a day for 3 days?
Right. Gavin, what about for you? That time when you were you had left Cafe Bleu to New York and when you got Spoon and Stable open, what was Did what you had in your head when you left your old job and what ended up on the menu and coming out of the kitchen, was there a did something evolve during those months just by virtue of having time to reflect, have some perspective, to let your sort of, you know, subconscious work a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I really only had, honestly, I only had 1 month between the two. You know, I left Cafe May 31st. I moved to Minneapolis, and then July 7th, we took the space over and started construction the next day. And, you know, for better or worse, I was at the restaurant or construction site every day because I just wanted to know where all the pipes were going. I wanted to understand the whole, the ins and outs of everything. The weirdest thing for me was that the day actually ended at 5, which I was used to the day beginning at 5. Even if I went into work at 10 o'clock in the morning, the curtain opened at 5 o'clock. So, you know, that was the weirdest part for me when the restaurant was being built, is like, okay, so emails kind of, they actually slowed down or stopped shortly thereafter. So I had to just kind of recalibrate my life, and I just said, okay, instead of answering any emails during the day because people get back to you too quickly, I would just wait. I would do all the emails in the morning from the night before, and then at 5 o'clock I'd go through all my other emails at 5, from like 5 to 8. So at least I felt like I was doing 10 or 12 hours of work a day, because otherwise it just didn't feel like much to me. So, but it also gave me an opportunity to do something that I've never done, which was cook dinner and eat dinner with my family every night.
Right.
Which was really an exciting experience for me, and, you know, something that my kids even had to get used to after the first week. They're like, when are you going to work?
Right.
You know, I'm like, Daddy's home for a while now. So, you know, that was cool. And, you know, we had a wood-burning grill that we bought at the restaurant. So I bought one for my house as well, so I could test out all these different woods in the backyard and grill on those. And so that was really an interesting experience.
Hey, Gavin, it's Jimmy. I wanted to ask you a question about that. You know, it sounds really pragmatic to me as a business owner to want to understand all the aspects of your business while you're building it. You know, the other side of it is the left brain and the right brain don't work the same way, and creativity has nothing to do with pragmatic thoughts. So did you feel that educating yourself, in immersing yourself in the construction and in the operations of the restaurant, took you away from creating the menu that you wanted? And when you opened, was it the menu that you always had in mind, or was it different than that for some reason?
You know, it probably took me away from the creation part. We had 6 weeks, so the back kitchen was delivered to us 6 weeks before we opened. So we had 6 weeks where I could stay away from it. And basically, at that time, I stopped going to design meetings. I stopped figuring out what paint should go on the wall. And I just left that to my wife and to the whole design team, and I stayed out of it. So then I could get into the kitchen. The menu that we opened with versus the menu we have now is different, of course. The menu we opened with, I think, was probably different than what I anticipated as well. But we needed to understand what we were cooking with and who we were cooking with. That was the biggest difference for me. The level of the cooks were very different. So in hindsight, I probably would have even taken more time to just be in the kitchen, you know, versus 6 weeks. Maybe I would have taken, you know, 2 months or more to be in the kitchen with the whole team and try to figure out exactly what we wanted to do. But I was really immersed into trying to figure out how that restaurant was getting built.
You know, it's interesting, and Amanda, maybe you could jump in on this, but when you said, you know, you miss the evening, you know, work starts at 5, you know, people who don't cook, you know, you think, God, you know, it's such hard work, it's physical work, it must be great to have, you know, a couple of months where you're not doing that every night. But, I mean, when you were in the in-between, did you miss it?
God, no. I loved it. It was awesome. I felt like a human being. I was like, wow, and I think it's sort of the same thing we've all said. When you're out of the restaurant, you're still working on other projects. So you have a job, and it's like a 9-to-5 job. And yes, you're in meetings, you're doing everything, but it does end at like 5:30. And it's hard for people who aren't in restaurants. It's even hard for my daytime crew, because they're like, oh, you're not really in the kitchen during the daytime. I'm like, I know, because my day does start at 5:30 when the doors open. And that's my real job for the next 6 hours when I'm expediting the kitchen. And that's really when I feel like I'm working my hardest. But I get to work at 9 or 10 a.m. and I'm writing emails and doing interviews and all kinds of things. So when we had that time off and I could just go home and be like, wow, I could go to a movie tonight. I can go out for dinner. I don't have to have somebody, you know, take over my shift. It was amazing. We always had a little dirt candy. We had a window, and I don't know why, but like on Saturdays and Sundays, people would walk by eating ice cream cones during the summer at like 2 o'clock. And I was like, wow, that's just like the ideal fantasy. You have 2 o'clock off on like a Saturday and you can walk around eating ice cream. Those people are so lucky. And so for a couple of months, I ate ice cream on Saturdays, walking around, looking at people in restaurants going, ha ha, look at me. Right. I'm getting to eat my ice cream cone while you're working. And that time off was actually, it was important for all of us. My cooks all actually were still working for me. We had 6 cooks who had stayed with us from Little Dirt Candy to Big Dirt Candy. So they were in the kitchen every day testing things and we were going through all the recipes. But what we all discovered was that we were nicer people and nicer to each other, the more sort of like structured, less time we were working. And that is something that we put into practice at Big Dirt Candy, where we try to keep working hours down to 40, 50 at the most, because I really want my cooks, everybody who works for me, to have a life. It is so important.
Yeah. Is a byproduct?
I think that's a good point, is that having the time off makes you reassess what balance means for you.
Yeah.
And because we do a very similar work schedule. It's 40 hours a week. Everybody works 4 days and then 3 days off. And it's balance is really important. And I think that's having that time off, you actually realize that that exists in the world.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's probably a topic we could spend a whole show on, because like when you guys all came up, I mean, balance, you know, like what there, you know, was.
We're not talking about how much acid versus how much sweetness in balance.
Right.
We're talking about the balance that you try to achieve in your life.
Right. But I'm saying during for probably all 4 of you, including you, Jimmy, like when you came up, balance in your life wasn't really.
No.
You know, people talk about I worked 6 days a week and
balance was what's the level of sacrifice you're willing. What's your threshold on sacrifice?
Right.
That's where your balance was measured.
Right. Right. How much of your Sunday is spent doing the laundry versus how much is spent catching up on sleep?
Yeah.
Right?
Will you still go to work with a third degree burn, you know?
Right.
I think one of the things is that you don't want to get to a point in your career where you are there to serve the customers and you don't want to start resenting them. And it's really important to figure out that balance.
Right.
Really well said.
Well, on that note, as always, time flies when you're on the air. We've come to the end of our first episode. A couple of things before we thank our guests. We want to thank our engineer, Liz Smith, who we just met today. Thank you, Liz, for piloting our ship. Do you own a knife company or a chefware business, a cooking school? We don't have a sponsor yet. Heritage is very nice about putting new shows on the air for a little while without one. If this sounds like something you might be interested in, send me and Jimmy a note. Hosts, at frontburnerpodcast.org. Thanks to Storefront Music for our theme song, Heavy Metal Gumbo. If you have any feedback for us or an idea for a segment, give us a shout at that same email, host@frontburnerpodcast.org. Again, I'm Andrew Friedman. You can visit me at Tokeland.com and follow me on Instagram and Twitter at ToklandAndrew. And you can visit Jimmy and enjoy his food and hospitality at the Red Cat in New York City. Follow him on Twitter at RedCatNYC and Instagram at Chef Jimmy Bradley. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. Each episode of The Front Burner will live on in perpetuity at the Heritage Radio Network website and also on iTunes and Stitcher. And we would now like to thank our guests. Please support them in their restaurants. Amanda Cohen from Dirt Candy in New York City, Gavin Kazin from Spoon and Stable in Minneapolis, and Chef Harold Moore, soon to be at Harold's Meat and 3 in New York City. That's it. Next week on The Front Burner, with Jimmy and Andrew, our guests will include Kat Kinsman, Chef Jesse Schenker, and a return guest from one of our pilots who was so great and has such a great radio voice, Frank Crispo of Crispo Restaurant in New York City. We'll be back. We'll be talking about chefs with issues and anything else that breaks between now and then. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.